That ballistic missile strike on bases in Iraq, the retaliation Iran promised, or could it be something else? A Texas-based expert sorts out the facts today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. Could Texas's official computers get caught in the crosshairs between rising Iran-U.S. tensions? What state officials say about new cyber attacks and where they appear to be coming from? Also, separating truth from fiction when it comes to a military draft, a fact check on a claim about kids and cancer from one Texas official, plus a whole lot more. No matter where you are, Texas Standard Time gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 8th day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. Thanks so much for joining us. This morning, if you were listening to NPR, you may have heard the report on Iran's missile launches targeting U.S. bases in Iraq last night, described as, well, here's the retaliation they promised. Let's pause for a moment and reflect on whether that's actually what's happened over the last 24 hours. The facts as we know them shortly after sundown in Texas, more than a dozen ballistic missiles were reported to have been launched at two bases in Iraq where U.S. forces are stationed. The U.S. Joint Command in Baghdad, which oversees both Iraqi and international troops, including Americans, announced no Americans or Iraqis or international forces with them had been killed in these missile strikes. But note the striking difference in the way the story was told in Iran. Fars, a news outlet associated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, said that at least 80 U.S. troops had been killed. 80. Again, there's no independent evidence that's true. Iran's foreign minister took to the loudspeaker of choice in public diplomacy these days, which is to say Twitter, announcing to the world, quoting here, "Iran took and concluded proportionate measures in self-defense," adding, "We do not seek any escalation or war, but will defend ourselves against any aggression." So let's get back to the question we started with. Is this, in fact, the retaliation Iran promised, or is it something else? Aaron O'Connell teaches military history at the University of Texas at Austin. He served as special advisor to General David Petraeus in Afghanistan and to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. Professor O'Connell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
What do we know so far about these ballistic missiles launched Tuesday? Presumably, they hit their targets, these two bases, right?
Well, yes, yeah, some of them did. I think the first point to remember is that Iran has had its militias launch rockets and rocket-propelled grenades in the past. These are not those. These are ballistic missiles. They're much more advanced. They're short and medium-range ballistic missiles, and Iran has lots of these. When I say lots, I mean thousands that can easily range the American bases in Iraq. This is an escalation. I do not think it is the entire escalation. It may be the only overt military escalation, but Iran is doing a number of other things on the diplomatic, political fronts that are also part of its response to the Soleimani killing.
I want to get back to that aspect of it, but I want to understand the significance of using ballistic missiles in this context. If you could have launched from within Iraq, why would you use ballistic missiles, which presumably are a lot more expensive?
They are. They're more expensive, they're more powerful, and most importantly, they can go a lot farther. So these were some of Iran's short and medium range ballistic missiles. They also have long range missiles that can range out to 1,000 kilometers at least. The reason they wanted to launch from inside Iran was to give a clear message that this came from the regime. It was not a rogue militia actor in Iraq. So it is a form of communication from the government of Iran to the United States about its ability to hold American assets at risk.
That is my question. Is the chief, I mean, obviously to send a message is what I hear you saying. And clearly a message has been received by the United States that Iran has this capability. Not that we didn't know that they did to begin with. I wonder if this was a communication to the Iranian people as well.
It most certainly was. I think the primary audience for this strike was the Iranian people and the regime hardliners who demanded some sort of military response. The numbers they're throwing around about having killed 80 Americans are obviously not only unverified, but unlikely, if not outright false at this point. And that is for domestic consumption. Not it is not an accurate assessment of what actually transpired.
Would the United States have known in advance that a ballistic strike was forthcoming?
We can, and we did. These are things we can watch. They have to be fueled. They have to be moved. They have to be launched. These are all things we can prepare for. We did prepare for them, which is probably part of the reason no Americans have been killed thus far. But the point is not just whether or not Iran can hit our people. Their point is that they can launch these missiles as well as other military assets at times and places of their choosing, all of which will, if not kill Americans, undermine our efforts to work with the Iraqi government to counter ISIS and to have an Iraqi-American military partnership.
What do you think this means in terms of whether or not we should expect more strikes from Iran? If, in fact, they've convinced their own people that they have retaliated, and you parse that response from the Iranian foreign minister, Iran took and concluded proportionate measures in self-defense. We do not seek any escalation, but we'll defend ourselves. What do you read between the lines here?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that Iran purposely used the word proportionate, not only to be in line with just war theory and international norms of warfare, but because President Trump explicitly said he might offer a disproportionate response. Mm. So that is Iran seizing the moral high ground in the argument by saying we will only fight in the ways that the world deems acceptable, which means proportionate responses to violent and lethal force. So I don't think we will see more Iranian strikes, provided that the United States does not re-escalate. But that's actually not the most important point, David, because mistaking military strikes as the entire response would blind us to the fact that Iran is doing many things on the political front to force the Iraqi government to try to eject American forces from Iraq. That's been Iran's number one goal since 2003. They succeeded in it with the 2011 withdrawal. And because of the ISIS invasion, our forces are back in. So even if they don't strike us militarily, they are responding to the Soleimani killing by doing a full force push on the Iraqi government to eject American forces. And that would have really disastrous consequences for Iraq and for the fight against ISIS.
Aaron O'Connell teaches military history at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor, thanks so much for spending some of your time with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be here.
Well, here may be an intriguing subplot. Is Texas in the crosshairs of this back and forth between the U.S. and Iran? During a domestic terrorism roundtable between state lawmakers and agency leaders yesterday, Governor Greg Abbott and state cybersecurity experts said that over the past 2 days, as many as 10,000 probes per minute of state agencies' IT systems appeared to be coming from Iran. Robert T. Garrett is the Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he's been covering this story. Bob, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
Possible cyber attacks from Iran. Is that the way that this is being styled by Texas officials?
That's right. They have apparently a way of seeing the origin of these probes, and they weren't watching Iran before recently, so they don't have a baseline number to compare the recent activity with, but they believe it was a significant increase lately.
Now, is there any hard evidence that they're publicly sharing with reporters such as yourself when it comes to, you know, the possibility that Iran is trying to probe for vulnerabilities in the state's computer systems?
Well, I think the governor and other Texas officials are reading the same news everyone is, and that is a speculation that, you know, Iran may use cyber attacks as one of the ways to retaliate for the killing of their top general. They basically acknowledge, they being the Texas officials we interviewed yesterday, that they have no evidence that there's any government of Iran sanctioned or launched cyber attacks. It was interesting, though, that Vice News first reported that a hacker got on Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller's Texas Department of Agriculture website with a picture of the general who had been killed in a drone strike, and it said hacked by Iranian hacker. Sid Miller said they caught it immediately and took that down, and it did no harm, but that was at least an illustration that there's some activity.
Well, it's interesting that, first of all, that the Department of Agriculture's website would be hacked and defaced, apparently, publicly. The other part of this, though, is whether or not this is coming from Iran or if it's coming from some kind of, hackers without any actual affiliation with the Islamic Republic, right? I mean, it's a real question here at this point.
Right, yes. And, we're going into the 2020 election year not knowing whether there are bots out there in Russia or Eastern Europe that are creating divisions among Americans. So everything is suspect at this point.
Well, I guess, yes, I don't want to be too cavalier about this, but I suppose that given that there are these vulnerabilities and given all of the anxiety that's in the air at the moment, how confident should Texans be in their government's cybersecurity? I mean, clearly the governor wants to send a message there that we're, taking our defenses seriously. But if the Agriculture Commissioner's website can be hacked at a time when we're talking about possible hits on our system by Iranians, what do you make of it?
Well, as someone who's watched a lot of state government IT contracting debacles over the last 20 years, I wouldn't say I have high confidence that people couldn't perpetrate problems. Now, I have no reason to engender fear that, confidential information or anything is at risk. The Department of Information Resources Chief Amanda Crawford did say that they get billions of these probes each day. So it's hard to know in context how big a threat this is.
Bob Garrett is Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, continues to cover this story. Bob, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it, David.
All right, let's find out now what Texans are talking about. Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Reactions pouring in on social media regarding Iran this morning. We've learned no U.S. forces were killed in that Iranian missile attack on facilities based in Iraq, the attack retaliation for the U.S. drone strike that killed an Iranian general last week. On our Facebook page, Linda Crisp says the president and Congress need to take an off-ramp immediately. This may be our last opportunity. James Art Exum writes that when Trump was elected, I suspected that his impulsivity and poor judgment would either get him impeached or into a regional war. Now I'm afraid both of these instances may come to pass. Tyler Malloy says this about the political situation in the Middle East. Iran's primary goal is to get the U.S. out of the region. Iraq just voted for the U.S. to leave their country. Trump seemingly accomplished what the Iranian military could not. However, the president not without his supporters. Jose Javier writes, when I was growing up, U.S. hostages in Iran were on TV every day. It still makes my blood boil. Do our grandchildren deal with this, or do we? Just some of the reactions coming in there, David. I'll be back with more about this situation and other stories from social media later in the show.
What about that story about Enrique Iglesias? Have you heard about this?
Oh, yeah. We've got some takes about that.
How much McAllen paid for his visit back in 2015? We'd love to know what's making news in your neck of Texas. Tweet us right now.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology. With more than 210 cancer centers across the state, patients can access technology, research, and treatment options in their local communities. More at texasoncology.com.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Cities across Texas readying themselves for the next promised revolution in tech. 5G networks from big telecoms like AT&T and T-Mobile that could make today's data connections feel like yesterday's slow modems. But at the same time, cities across Texas are battling the state and federal governments over what some have called a corporate giveaway. From San Antonio, Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more.
The next generation of cellular networks is really fast, but 5G also requires a lot more cellular nodes. The business-friendly Texas legislature, looking to facilitate the quick rollout of the technology, limited many local government powers to regulate who puts the new small cell nodes where, as well as capping the amount that can be charged to access city-owned right-of-ways and poles. The Texas Municipal League's Scott Houston says they sued the state, arguing it's unconstitutional and will cost cities.
As they began the rollout of 5G and more of these nodes were going to be put up, it was going to eventually start costing city taxpayers over $800 million a year in lost right-of-way rental revenue.
The lawsuit's ongoing and has since been overshadowed by another challenger, the Federal Communications Commission. The FCC, using Texas as a template, changed the rules to reflect the same right-of-way caps and limitations. Local governments across the country are now suing the feds. Jerry Lederer is representing cities and says in some cases they can't even recoup the amount of money it costs to process the applications. Rather than spurring innovation, the rules, he argues, now build barriers for new companies to enter as established telecoms take over the best and densest parts of downtown.
It's a land grab, you know. I mean, it's people trying to go out and grab as much property as you can at the lowest possible prices. And again, if it's a subsidized price, you'll grab more than you need, right?
Lederer will argue in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals February 10th. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. For nearly 50 years, it's been a perfunctory rite of passage of sorts. Since 1973, American men at age 18 have been required to register with the U.S. Selective Service, effectively adding their name to a potential draft pool in the event the military falls short of soldiers and needs more to fight. Within hours of the U.S. airstrike on Iraq last week that killed Iran's top commander, online interest in the draft soared. So much, in fact, that as New York Times national reporter Sarah Mervosh found, so many people were visiting the Selective Service System website, it crashed. Sarah, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
The agency issued a statement after their servers crashed, urging people not to believe disinformation about the return of the draft. But I guess it does, the question is still hanging out there. Under what conditions might a military draft actually be revived?
Yeah, everyone I talked to basically indicated that there would have to be some, you know, strong military event, you know, not just speculation, but actually something like a total war where enough soldiers were needed. And there would actually have to be an act of Congress. It's not enough to simply say, oh, my name is registered with the Selective Service. Could I be eligible? In fact, Congress would have to pass a law reinstating the draft, mm-hmm. and the president would have to sign off. So I think there'd have to be some pretty broad political support for that to happen.
I was trying to remember when the draft was last used. I guess it would have been during the Vietnam era. And before that, it would have been World War II, right?
Right. It's been used on and off, you know, throughout U.S. history, starting with the Civil War and then during World War I and World War II. Mm-hmm. And then basically from the 40s on, it was basically used. And then in 1973, during Vietnam War and sort of opposition, the draft was abolished. And so there has not been conscription since 1973.
Although I do remember, and I'll just say it. Back in the late 70s, I had to go to the post office and fill out my Selective Service card. So what exactly was I doing there in filling out my name and my address and all that stuff? And is my information still floating out there in the Selective Service system?
You know, that's a good question. So the Selective Service System is an independent government agency. It's separate from the Department of Defense. Okay. And its job is basically just to collect some basic information about young men. And they keep that information on hand should there be a draft. There are some penalties if you don't register. So, for example, if you're a young man, this does not apply to women currently, but if you're a young man at age 18, you are expected to register with the Selective Service System. And if you don't do it for the rest of your life, you cannot receive federal financial aid and you cannot work for the federal government should you want to. But I don't know the answer to whether your information is floating around out there in space. But the good news is if you registered, you're eligible for those benefits.
I want to get back to something that you just said a moment ago about women being excluded from this process. Is that an artifact of the times when the draft was formally ended, or what exactly?
You know, women have not been eligible for the draft for U.S. history. But in 2015, the Pentagon announced that women would be eligible for all combat jobs. Mm-hmm. And so that has been the case for the past 5-6 years. And so there actually is a commission right now looking at that issue. The National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service has been examining whether all people should be required to register for the selective service system, and should there be a draft, should they be eligible? And they've been examining that question of whether women should be included because they are now eligible for combat roles.
Mm-hmm.
And they are expected to issue their final report this March. So just coming up this spring, we may have some more answers on that.
In fact, I think a federal judge in Houston has ruled that excluding women from the draft would be unconstitutional. What about traction on this idea? You think that there's popular support for it?
It sounds like, based on the conversations that this commission has had, that there's a wide variety of opinions. But the fact that they're examining this and there's a bipartisan commission charged by Congress to answer this question is indication of some traction. And I think coming up here in the next few months, we'll see what they come up with. And perhaps, you know, given that they are charged explicitly with answering that question, we should have some answers here soon.
Is there any real move from what you can tell, Sarah, about when it comes to bringing back the draft? I mean, obviously, you said when we began our conversation that some precipitous military event might mean that we would have a return to the draft. But you'd first have to have what? Some action of Congress, as I understand it.
Correct. Congress would have to pass a law and the president would have to sign off to reinstate the draft. So far, we are nowhere near that happening. But people are certainly concerned. Young people who have never lived through something like this before, who have a lot of questions, are talking about it in the cafeteria, searching online, and parents also have some questions about what could happen to their young people. So this just seems to be the result of some anxieties among young people today. But so far, again, it's one of those things that to actually reinstate the draft would be a big deal, and it would require an act of Congress and sign off by the president. And we have not seen that yet. And so it's one of those things where, you know, I think the general thought is, you know, hold off on any extreme fears until you actually see something like that happen.
Sarah Mervosh is national reporter for The New York Times. We'll link to her piece at texasstandard.org. Sarah, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Time flies. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. You know what's happening next, right? It's the Texas Roundup, a roundup of what's making news across the Lone Star State. So you want to stick around for that. We'll see you on the other side.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Many Texas Republicans in Congress are seeking to reassure the public that the recent military conflicts between the U.S. and Iran are not leading to another ground war in the Middle East. During a press conference in Washington this morning, Houston Congressman Dan Crenshaw joined colleagues in defending President Trump's airstrike killing an Iranian general last week. Commenting on Iran's missile attacks against U.S. bases in Iraq, Crenshaw says it's false to assume the U.S. can either do nothing or start a war with Iran.
The president is not taking us to all-out war. There is a lot in between, and we have to be more honest about that fact. We have to set a red line and say that as the United States of America, we will not be punished indefinitely. We have to take action.
Meanwhile, on the U.S. House floor this morning, Austin Democratic Congressman Lloyd Doggett said killing Iranian General Qasem Soleimani has created more U.S. opposition in the Middle East.
So after abandoning our Kurdish allies and surrendering that part of the Middle East to our adversaries, Trump has now managed to unite the many people that were favorable to the United States and were questioning the very malicious presence of Iran.
Doggett and other Democrats want Congress to pass legislation limiting the president's ability to wage war with Iran. Texas lawmakers are touring the state this week, getting input on how to redraw the state's political maps in 2021. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Tomorrow's Texas House Redistricting Committee hearing is in El Paso, followed by another Friday in the same city. The panel will get a chance to hear testimony from the public and state government experts. It's supposed to help lawmakers determine the political boundaries for Congress and the state legislature, which get redrawn following each census. State lawmakers are expected to get that data by April 2021. Other redistricting hearings are planned for later this month in Plano and Arlington. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Texas is poised to be the first state in the country to execute a death row inmate in 2020. John Gardner, now 64, is scheduled to die by lethal injection next Wednesday. He was convicted of fatally shooting his estranged wife, 41-year-old Tammy Gardner, in 2005. Seven additional executions are scheduled through May. Kristen Houlet heads the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty and points out that fewer than half of the executions scheduled last year were carried out.
I fully expect that the cases that are scheduled for execution now present many of the same troubling issues that have been raised in Texas cases for the last four decades.
Houlet says that fewer death sentences are being handed down in Texas. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. Long before she became an indelible symbol of Texas music and an icon of American culture immortalized on a U.S. postage stamp, she was a Tejano singing sensation with a sense of personal style that helped make her one of the most celebrated Mexican-American performers of the 20th century. You probably know who we're talking about. Selena Quintanilla Perez has been memorialized repeatedly in festivals and musical tributes in the 25 years since her murder at age 23. Now, a soon-to-open exhibition at the McNay Art Museum in San Antonio underscores the enduring image of Selena. Here to talk about that, Kate Carey. She is curator of the Selena Forever, Siempre Selena exhibition at San Antonio's McNay, where she is head of education. Kate, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us a little bit about where the idea came from for the Siempre Selena exhibition.
I'd love to. I am currently working on another exhibition called Fashion Nirvana, Runway to Everyday. And with that term Nirvana, I hope you're thinking of the 1990s. And so what happened was we started thinking about who were the fashion icons of the 1990s. And of course, we were thinking about Selena. So we wanted to include Selena in this exhibition, but we also got an opportunity right at the same time to display some photography of Selena by a San Antonio photographer named John Dyer. He had photographed her twice, and we were able to get his permission to show five of these photographs at the McNay. And it's the kind of situation where it became its own exhibition once we saw these photographs. It'll still be on view at the same time as Fashion Nirvana, which opens up at the end of the month. But it's nice to be able to have this specific solo Selena moment at the McNay.
I like to explore this idea of Selena as a kind of a fashion icon too, because a big part of it was her overall image, her look just pops in these pictures. Holy smokes.
Yeah, she's absolutely the architect of her own image. She's one of these artists that was very in tune to what perceptions of her were, and she wanted to determine what that would look like. So she was a designer. She had two shops where her clothes could be sold, and one in San Antonio, one in Corpus. And so she definitely pursued that part of her fashion interests.
And that's something that I think a lot of people forget about, especially those who just know Selena through, say, what they've heard about her in the media and that sort of thing. Tell us a little bit about the story behind these images. You mentioned the photographer who took these pictures was on assignment, I gather.
Right. So the photographer's name is John Dyer. He lives in Boerne, Texas, and he's a photographer that's been hired by Time, by Elle, by Newsweek, by Texas Monthly. And he was hired to take her picture in 1992 for a magazine called Moss Magazine. And she was sort of an on-the-rise star, not necessarily as well-known as she became. And then he was hired again in 1995 to do a spread on Selena in Texas Monthly. And sadly, between the time he took the photograph at the Majestic Theater here in San Antonio in 1995, between the time he took those photographs and the time the they were published in Texas Monthly, Selena was murdered. And the place we've identified for this exhibition, kind of internally, we've been calling it the Selena Chapel, is an octagonal gallery. So it has eight sides. And on three of the walls, we'll have large blow-ups of Selena. And so it's going to be a contemplative or a meditative space.
Yeah. Let me ask you about something related to your work as someone who directs educational outreach activities. They're head of education at the McNay.
Sure.
Do you think that Selena, my sense of it is that certainly among my contemporaries, we all know who Selena is and everything, but what about younger generations? Do you think that her image endures or perhaps not so much?
I do think her image endures. I think that she... I think that her music certainly still lives. For example, there are tribute bands that still perform her music. We're going to have one of them, Bitty Bitty Banda from Austin, who has performed quite a bit in Austin. They'll perform here at the McNay in March. So I think her music endures. And I think because of that, her image endures as well. So that part is really what we're excited about is showing the image of her and in tandem with sort of the fashionable garments in a related gallery.
Kate Carey is curator of the Selena Forever Siempre Selena exhibition, which opens on the 15th at San Antonio's McNay. Kate, great to have you on the Texas Standard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Hi, it's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Lots of Texans have friends and family abroad, and for some, reestablishing a connection can be as simple as a phone call. Others, however, might never have such an opportunity. KERA's Stella Chavez reports on a project in Dallas to bring people from all corners of the world together in the same room.
On a recent December morning, 520-somethings huddle inside a gold shipping container at Bonton Farms in southeast Dallas. It's like a mini movie auditorium with a large projector screen. They're talking with two young men in Herat, Afghanistan.
What is the temperature there?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's not that much cold. 72
72?
It's 40 in Dallas, but outside this cold container, it feels closer to 30.
It's Celsius here. It's like 5. It's cold. We're all shaking, right?
This shipping container is called a portal. They're placed all over the world courtesy of a nonprofit called Shared Studios. The mission is simple: connect people who may otherwise never get the chance to meet. Inside the Dallas portal is a group from City Year, an education nonprofit that works in public schools and mentors students at risk of dropping out. Their new friends are Hamid Namani, a recent high school graduate, and Saeed Habibi, curator of the Herat portal. Namani says he wants to attend an American university and study electrical engineering. One of the things they're discussing is immigration.
As a citizen of the United States, what's your first impression of seeing a huge gathering of people coming into your country?
So Namani is asking how they feel about people coming to the U.S. Everyone looks at Oscar Hernandez. He's 25 and wants to study immigration law after he wraps up his stint with City Year.
I think it's a very pressing issue, considering that we've been having a lot of political turmoil in Washington over the status of refugees, especially.
Bonton Farms is an interesting location for the Dallas portal. It's an urban farm, market, and cafe in an area south of downtown, often described as a food desert. Ricky Jimerson is vice president of operations there. He says having the portal has been a rewarding experience and hopes to bring it back in the spring.
I think it was interesting for us is the fact that we really saw an opportunity to expose our community to a whole new world. Number one, to see some of the commonalities we have with people all over the world. Number two, to appreciate some differences and learn something new about other people. as well as teach them something that you're doing.
That's something 21-year-old Beverly Manriquez was eager to experience.
I really loved it. I've had other opportunities to talk to people in other countries, but this felt different just because of the screen and how you see them full size. Felt like they were in the room with us.
Elizabeth Bonnell is 22 and teaches geometry and algebra. She was particularly interested in understanding water scarcity and how that creates conflict.
I found the water dispute very interesting. I feel like I'm not as well informed about using water for power sources and how it's being pumped out of one country and being used to benefit another.
Communicating through these portals can help build bridges. Matthew Kartal is curator for the Dallas site.
Being in Afghanistan or in the U.S. or in Mexico or in other country, you face with the same struggle and realities. You have to earn a living, find shelters, and have some food.
And, he says, the experience can also be pure fun as Nemani and Habibi wrap up the conversation with some music and dancing for their Dallas friends. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
Well, it's not like you don't have time to prepare your celebration. Later this year, we'll mark the 175th year of Texas statehood. It was December 29th, 1845, when Texas officially joined the United States of America. Or as the proudest of Texans, including our own W.F. Strong, might say, the day the U.S. was allowed to join Texas.
Though the 29th was the day that President Polk signed the joint resolution that made Texas a state, there was some confusion as to the official moment that the Republic of Texas passed into history and statehood status began. Then President of Texas Anson Jones said that February 19, 1846 was the actual day. He presided over a ceremony in Austin where the Republic of Texas flag was lowered for the last time, and the U.S. flag was raised in its place. As you might surmise, the almost 2 months difference in official transfer of power led to problems. For instance, who should you pay import duties to, Texas or the U.S.? Lawsuits followed. The U.S. Supreme Court eventually weighed in on the matter, and the official date of statehood was established as December the 29th, 1845. Make your checks payable to the U.S. Treasury, please. Texas couldn't just let President Polk's signing of a document 1,500 miles away be all there was to the moment. They couldn't allow the Republic, so many had died for, to pass into history without memorializing the moment in some proper way. So President Anson arranged a ceremony in front of the Texas Capitol, really just a house, that would turn out to both mourn the passing of the Republic and celebrate Texas as the newest state in the Union. What was needed here is what linguists call a speech act, a moment in time where something is made real by virtue of pronouncement. I pronounce you man and wife, or I sentence you to 20 years in prison. Anson Jones began with, I, as President of the Republic, am now present to surrender into the hands of those whom the people have chosen the power and authority we have for some time held. Noah Smithwick, a blacksmith in attendance, remembered the moment the Texas flag came down. Many a head was bowed, many a broad chest heaved, and many a manly cheek was wet with tears when that broad field of blue, in the center of which, like a signal light, glowed the Lone Star, emblem of the sovereignty of Texas, was furled and laid away among the relics of the dead Republic. The United States flag was raised, and the mood changed dramatically. Noah wrote, "We were, most of us, natives of the United States, and when the Stars and Stripes, the flag of our fathers, was run up, and catching the breeze unrolled its heaven-born colors to the light, cheer after cheer went up in the air. The people celebrated statehood." I like that Noah tended already toward that creature still common in Texas, the exceptionally proud Texan. He said that he thought the star in the lower left corner of the U.S. flag should have been especially dedicated to Texas. It's as if he wanted it framed and separated in some way. How Texan of him. So the flag raising complete, President Anson Jones announced the Republic of Texas is no more, making it politically true, but never absolute, because the residual influence of the Republic resides in the minds of many Texans today who still think of her as their country, their nation. No doubt it was a bittersweet day, but 94% of Texans did vote for statehood, a level of agreement we haven't enjoyed since. There was great happiness on the whole. Tyler, Texas, was founded that same year in gratitude to U.S. President John Tyler, who started the movement for Texas annexation. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication, University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. We serve quite a few over at TexasStandard.org. Check them out over there, too. You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Congressman Mike McCall, who represents part of Central Texas in Washington, says that, quote, 80% of children born in developing countries die of cancer each year. Come again? Is that really the case? Here to look into it, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Hello there again, Madeline.
Hey there, good to see you.
I have to say, when you have a number like 80% of children born in developing countries die of cancer, right off the bat, I'm thinking, something's wrong here.
What the heck is he talking about?
Yeah. Right. What was the context of this quote?
So we had a reader actually flagged this tweet for us that came from the congressman. He was sharing it to advocate for Congress passing his legislation that would help improve access to cancer treatments for kids around the world. Mm-hmm. And he was sharing the statistic to kind of paint a picture of what they're dealing with. And
pretty dramatic picture, I have to say.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll read the full tweet for you. He said, "A child's chance of surviving cancer should not be determined by where they are born. But sadly, this is the case. 80% of children born in developing countries die of cancer each year. That's why I introduced the Global Hope Act, so children have access to life-saving treatments."
I see. So did you immediately start looking into this statistic once you were alerted to it?
That's right. And the first thing I did, as always, was reach out to his office to ask where this statistic came from.
Uh-huh.
And they pointed me to a World Health Organization study that looked at childhood cancer around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the study stated that just 20% of childhood cancers are cured in the developing country.
Just 20% of childhood cancers are cured in developing countries.
That's right.
Wait a minute. So I'm seeing some sort of logical subtraction error here going on. Am I close?
That's right. So the way that the study phrased this, they said in high-income countries, more than 80% of children with cancer are cured. But in many low and middle income countries, only about 20% are cured. So you're right. If we're looking at this, if 20% of children with cancer are cured, safe to assume that 80% are not in these developing countries. But that does not mean what Congressman McCall said, which is that every year in developing countries, 80% of all children born are going to die of cancer.
Yikes. So did his office know that there was a statistical problem here in the way that the numbers were interpreted?
They did after I reached out to them and asked about
this. But not
this.
Until, huh?
Not until then.
Yikes.
But they did point me to, in the tweet that had the statistic, there included a video. And in the video, he says a more accurate version of this statistic.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue here is that you have to watch into the video. The statistic in the tweet is incredibly startling. Uh-huh. It was flagged by a reader. So clearly it was just an error in the wording of this tweet. And perhaps they did know the accurate statistic.
So he misquoted or maybe misspoke.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I wonder if there is anything else that you found that might reveal anything on this, or are we ready to make a call here?
I think we're ready to make a call, but I'll say that we did check other studies to see if they reflected the same same survival rates for childhood cancer as the World Health Organization report. And they did, generally speaking, although it's hard to study these cases in developing countries, generally about 80 to 90% of these cases are not cured in developing countries.
So the underlying statistics are valid. It's just the way that he framed it in this tweet.
Exactly.
Okay. So what is the ruling from PolitiFact Texas on Mike McCall's claim?
So given all of that context, we rated this claim mostly false.
Mostly false. That's the ruling on Mike McCall's claim that 80% of kids in developing countries die of cancer each year. Not true. He's actually misquoting a claim from the WHO. It appears inadvertently that 20% of children with cancer in developing countries are cured. That's from Madeline Meckelberg and the fact checkers over at PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, as always, good to see you, and we will see you next week.
Looking forward to it.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. That sound means we are joined once again by our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are you hearing, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, reaction coming in after President Trump's remarks regarding Iran this morning. President Trump stating that Iran appears to be standing down. He also defended the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani as having sent a valuable message to terrorists. He also added that the U.S. continues to evaluate options with respect to Iran, including what he called additional punishing economic sanctions. But I think many people, honestly, somewhat relieved to hear no further military action from the U.S. anticipated at this time. That's certainly the sentiment that was being shared there on our Facebook page. We shared the video there, so folks can go to our Facebook page there for Texas Standard and watch the video, share their own comments as well. So obviously, story that's not going anywhere, but
I don't know. It sounds like it's kind of going way of sort of simmering down a little bit. I mean, that's my sense of it.
That is the sense of it. I think, yeah, obviously those tensions are going to continue to simmer there. But yeah, it seems
we're
going to
be talking about this for some time. I think that's what. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's correct.
Well, shifting gears, you know, you brought this up earlier. It took several years and an official act at the Texas legislature, but now we finally know how much the city of McAllen paid one Enrique Iglesias to perform at a 2015 parade there. A whopping $485,000. That number, along with his rider, that list of demands that concert performers make when they perform. Some of the information finally being released here after this new law took effect.
Five years later.
Yeah, five years later. This long-withheld contract sort of became a symbol of local government secrecy until a new law prevented cities from withholding this sort of information on outside contracts. This was something that passed through on a bipartisan measure through the last session of the Texas legislature, overturning the so-called Boeing rule. This was what named for the aerospace manufacturer there. This said that, when cities negotiated contracts with private entities or outsiders, they didn't have to release that information. Well, now that has been overturned. And now we finally know, how much
I guess McAllen didn't want to mention that or didn't want to admit that they paid almost $500,000 for...
I guess not, although it's Enrique Iglesias. They did admit that that the city lost more than that, somewhere in the neighbor of $750,000 on a total loss for this thing, but they never revealed how much they paid the performer there. On our Facebook page, Ivan Rivera says, "I'm actually surprised it was so little. I would have thought he'd command more." He says, "I agree, however, that this is a waste of taxpayers' money, but silver lining, it was a bargain." However, Kim Nahara says that's a lot of money that would have helped hungry people. And this interesting comment here via Twitter from Jason Sabo. He says, "You know, some McAllen city staffer was patting him or herself on the back for saving that $15,000 there. That would have made it an even half a million dollars, $500,000. Yeah. But interesting, it'll be cool to see what other sort of long-sought information may be in the offing here now that this new law has taken effect as the new year takes effect.
Hey, check this out.
Yeah, what you holding there? I do. Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts. Check for $5 to No,
wait now. It's $55, I'll have you know. What this is all about? The Comptroller General's sitting on a lot of your money.
Oh, are you talking about Claim It Texas?
I am indeed. ClaimItTexas.org. You got to visit it because they have a lot of Texans' money, and they're looking for Texans to come forward and check out if Texas has any of your lost assets. And I found $55 right here.
ClaimItTexas.org. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you will join us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.